This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Last week, we examined a study from Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center that found drinking water at a third of farm worker camps in eastern North Carolina were contaminated. 61 of the 181 camps that were included in the report failed to meet current health standards, and two of them tested positive for E. coli. Professor of Family and Community Medicine at Wake Forest University, Dr. Thomas Arkery, helped draft the study. He says the majority of farmworker camps his team visited in eastern North Carolina had unsanitary or unsafe conditions. Dr. Arkery blames lax standards for farmworker housing and the lack of annual inspections as reason the water contamination hasn't been found until now.
There's only a requirement that there be one working showerhead for each 10 farm workers, that there only be one working toilet for each 15 farm workers, that there be one washing machine or wash tub for 30 farm workers. That's the current requirements. Those are fairly minimal.
However, when we spoke with the North Carolina Department of Labor's Agricultural Safety and Health Bureau Chief, Regina Cohen, she said inspections are performed on the water systems of farmworker camps on an annual basis.
Sometimes, absolutely, there are problems with the water. Sometimes growers have dug new wells. Sometimes they've chlorinated the water supply. If we are getting a call in the middle of the season saying, hey, there's a camp out here, they've got contaminated water, we refer that to the local health department and they'll go out and check.
Approximately 8,000 farm workers come to North Carolina on a H-2A visa annually. Greene County Healthcare Director Steve Davis says most live in state-regulated housing provided by the growers.
We have camps where there's only, you know, three workers in a room, and they each have their own access to satellite TV. They each have access to a telephone in that room, and also have air conditioning. You know, that's not a requirement. But then on the other hand, you know, we have camps where it's a trailer that literally you can almost see the outside through the holes in the walls, and, you know, you're scared to walk in there because you might fall through the floor. So it does vary a lot.
Davis has worked for 16 years with Greene County Healthcare, which provides care for migrant workers and underserved persons in 12 eastern North Carolina counties.
We serve, you know, Wilson, Wayne, Lenore, Duplin, Greene, Pitt, Martin, Pamlico, Craven, Carteret. You know, that's the main one.
The North Carolina Department of Labor has guidelines for farmworker housing that must pass inspection before occupancy can occur. The Bureau also performs inspections based on complaints and referrals.
They're very specific with their regulations and their guidelines, and they can come in and inspect your camp anytime they please.
The owner of Relier Farms in Greene County, Natalie Relier, says the Department of Labor's guidelines for migrant farmworker housing are meticulous.
And one of the strictest regulations that they have, and one that we always follow, is that there's a water sample taken every year, and it is tested. They inspect your septic systems and everything.
Natalie and her husband, John Relier, have owned and operated the farm, which is located approximately 9 miles south of Snow Hill, since 1975. They've been using migrant farm workers for 22 years. There are currently 9 migrant workers at Relier Farms. Some have been there since the start. Migrant workers perform a variety of jobs, mostly harvesting more than 200 acres of tobacco and produce. About 3 times a week, Relier says she and her husband conduct their own inspections of the housing, making sure the area is up to the Department of Labor's standards.
If there's any issues, we correct those. That would include, we do check, you know, the water, make sure the hot water systems are working properly. We check all of our smoke detectors to make sure that they're working properly. There can be no food left out. All the food has to be covered and placed in the refrigerator. All trash cans have to have liners and have covers. You have to provide proper bedding. The house has to be clean, and we abide by those rules.
Following the regulations, Relier says, is how she keeps the inspectors from finding violations and her workers happy.
The outcome of us making our money depends on our workers, and they are not mistreated. A lot of times you might have one farmer that gives everybody a bad name, but I can assure you that every farmer that I know that uses H-2A workers, we go above and beyond to meet the regulations and to take care of our guys.
While Relier says she considers her workers family, other growers in eastern North Carolina don't feel the same way. In a different study by Wake Forest University, researchers found infestations of roaches, mice, and rats, non-working toilets and showers, contaminated drinking water, and lack of fire safety equipment and smoke alarms were common at farmworker camps across eastern North Carolina. Ultimately, it's up to the growers to provide safe housing and access to clean water. In some cases, organizations like Greene County Healthcare have to intervene. Director Steve Davis.
Now, if it's something that's blatant, a health risk, a public health risk or something that can be very dangerous, then of course, if we have to, we'll take the appropriate steps. And a lot of times, it's not necessarily making a complaint being the first step. It's just going to the grower, letting them know what's going on, or going to the crew leader. And, more times than not, usually at that point, it's taken care of.
If you'd like more information on the community-based participatory approach to farmworker housing, exposures, and health study, you can find a link at our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. This is the Downeast Journal. One coastal county is working to control its feral cat population, while another local seaside community is trying to beef up its feral cat population. Stephen O'Connell has more.
On October 1st, Carteret County Animal Services received a grant that allows pet owners and animal caretakers to get a feline spayed or neutered and vaccinated. Animal Services has chosen to focus the program on in-home cats, outside cats, and feral cats in the town of Newport, where cat overpopulation has become a problematic issue. Joanne Schertzer, president of Encore Pets, a nonprofit organization serving Carteret County, says pet owners along the coast lack the money to properly take care of their animals, placing an extra burden on pet shelters.
For instance, in 2011, the state of North Carolina euthanized 52% of the dogs and 79% of the cats taken into public animal shelters. So it's a widespread problem across North Carolina. And many pet owners and caretakers in coastal North Carolina are financially unable to provide the spay and neuter services, necessary for the animals they care for.
Last year, there were approximately 2,300 cats left at Carteret County Animal Shelter. Animal Control Officer Tommy Bell is helping implement the free spay and neuter service, paid for by PetSmart Charities.
It's a day-by-day process. We have probably, right now, 300 or more applications that are in, and we have already scheduled those animals, and we're booked up until November because the veterinarians, we're working with them, and they're doing their regular clientele, plus they're adding our program into their clientele.
Bell says Animal Control plans to apply for more grants because of the project's impacts on the local cat population.
It's going to slow down our population of feral cats. It's going to slow down their travels in the neighborhood, from house to house. Spay and neuter animal will rest in the area of where they're fed. They won't go out and search for food.
In their travels, feral cats can spread disease to both wild cats and domesticated cats. An upper respiratory infection is one of the most commonly spread diseases. Although it's rarely deadly, symptoms can last for almost 3 weeks. Rabies is a deadly virus in nearly all cases, and although cats do not get the disease often, domestic animals are more likely to transmit the disease to humans. Although risk of disease may cause you to wonder why feral cats are left to roam the streets, Bell points out a benefit.
They keep the rodent population down around your home. Mice, snakes, bugs, rodents and insects carry disease that could involve with humans.
This is the exact reason an organization in Brunswick County is seeking to repopulate the town of Holden Beach with feral cats. Founder and president of the organization leading the effort, Sherry McLean, says the town would benefit by reintroducing wild felines into the environment.
They didn't have any colonies there at all, and they just thought that it would help.
Rescue Animals Community Effort, or RACE, is taking cats from Brunswick County's Animal Protective Services, spaying or neutering them, providing the proper vaccinations, and then releasing them. They've also recruited volunteers to monitor feral cat colonies. As well as controlling rodent population, McLean says the feral cats protect in-home and free-roaming felines.
feral colonies tend to keep other cats pushed out of the area, so you wouldn't be seeing as many cats coming into the area that weren't fixed.
McLean is excited about the program and expects to be releasing 2 to 3 cats a week on Holden Beach, depending on the availability of volunteers.
It's going to take probably 6 months to a year to actually colonize the island. It's a slow process. The cats have to be acclimated to their area and get used to it. But other than that, the program is running smoothly.
McLean stresses the importance of controlling the feral cat population. Feral cats gone unchecked will eventually end up in the animal shelters and most often be euthanized. Female cats may become fertile as early as 4 months old and together with their offspring produce over 10,000 cats in just 5 years. McLean says the program is more of an experiment at this point and is hoping to get at least 20 to 30 feral cats on Holden Beach in the next 6 months. If you would like to volunteer to watch over a feral cat colony, email the Rescue Animals Community Effort at raceshelter@yahoo.com. If you live in Newport and would like to spay or neuter your cat and get a distemper and rabies vaccination for it, call the Carteret County Health Department at 252-222-7748. If you don't have transportation, the Animal Services has volunteers that will come get your animal, bring it to one of the 5 veterinarians signed up for the service, and then return it to you. Bell says their goal is to spay and neuter 900 cats in the 2-year grant period. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. I realize that it's been a while since I gave you an update on the backyard chicken flock. Let's talk first about our 2 young girls that have just recently joined the flock. I can't call them hens because they're not laying eggs yet. They're pullets. They're just as big as the mature ladies, and they are beautiful. They're Rhode Island Red and Buff Orpington Cross. One is twice as big as the other. That's the one with white legs, more Buff Orpington. But they both are beautiful. And although they were raised in a separate pen until they were big enough to defend themselves, they're still mighty scared of the older girls, which peck at them whenever they try to come close to any special food treats. I expect eggs from these pullets any day. Then I can stop calling them girls and pullets and start calling them ladies and hens. And I'm looking forward to it. Our 3 older hens really are getting older. 2 of them are 5.5 years old. 1 is 4.5 years old. All 3 of them continue to lay most of the time, although not nearly as many eggs, and the quality's not as high as it used to be. One thing that's going on right now in the flock, and based on phone calls I've been getting, it's going on in lots of backyard chicken flocks, is fall molting. This is the time when hens lose a large number of their older feathers and replace them with new, beautiful feathers. It's a combination of hormones and how many hours of sunlight we have each day that determines when hens go into molt. Different breeds will also molt for a longer or shorter period of time. Sometimes, particularly with new flock owners, the first molt is quite frightening because all of a sudden, the coop and the run are completely filled with feathers. The hens themselves, well, they look fairly ratty. After a while, the new feathers grow in, and the hens look more beautiful than ever before. So how do you know if your hens are molting or if there's a problem with feather picking or some other problem? Well, if it's feather picking, and that's where hens actually pick at each other's feathers and can lead to really severe problems, you're going to see broken and frayed feathers, both on the ground and still on the hens. When a hen is molting, the feathers are intact and look very pretty on the ground. Pecking is caused by boredom and overcrowding, and so you can fix both by giving them perches to jump on and off of, heads of cabbage to swing from a string and peck at, but mostly plenty of space for each hen. Molting, you don't have to worry about fixing. It's a natural process, and it's going to happen every year. One way you know that molting has begun is not only the feathers in the bottom of the coop, but fewer eggs, because hens stop laying when they molt. But don't worry, not only will they start laying again, but after a molt, they lay eggs with better quality shells and better quality interiors. Now, in commercial settings, they will leave lights on at night or to extend the daylight so that hens don't go into a molt. You don't want to do that with your home flock. You want them to live a good, long, healthy life. And molting is part of that natural, healthy life. If you prevent them from molting, you may shorten their life and the quality of your eggs. When they come back into production, they will be doing beautifully, and you'll appreciate their eggs even more. And as for the new girls, well, I thought they were going to be laying a few weeks ago, and I want them to hurry up. I'm ready to see those tiny little pullet eggs that come with new hens. I now have 5 hens, and that's the maximum my coop can hold, so I won't be getting any new ones for a while. I hope you're enjoying your backyard hens, or think about getting some if you don't have any yet. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Inspiration for a songwriter can come from a variety of sources. The people you meet, the places you go. All true for Asheville resident Chuck Brodsky, performing tonight in Beaufort. And all represented on his 2006 CD, Tulips for Lunch. George Olson spoke with Chuck after the release of the disc, which originally aired in September of 2007.
If you've listened to the music of Chuck Brodsky for any length of time, you're most familiar with him in the guise of storyteller, his recounting of incidents or scenes of his rural community or those he's visited, or his baseball ballads recounting the tales of such folk as baseball clown Max Patkin or Fred Bonehead Merkel. Chuck's latest CD, Tulips for Lunch, continues that tradition. More baseball ballads, even a ping pong ballad, more about that later, but includes a few tunes where he's telling the story of no one.
I'd say this year need to complete an assignment.
That's Chuck's response to my question about the inspiration behind the tune, Two Left Feet.
I wasn't attracted, not on first glance. She wouldn't go away, I didn't want to dance. She lifted me up to my two left feet. My eyes went to the girl I was hoping to meet.
If you listen to Chuck's music, you tend to listen trying to decide whose story he's trying to tell. I thought Two Left Feet might be his own, Chuck being recently married. Nope. It was an assignment he received at a songwriter's retreat he teaches at in Michigan on a yearly basis.
What I've been primarily dealing with over the last several years are telling real people's stories. Specifically, I've been most interested in stories about what I referred to as ordinary people doing extraordinary things. So that's been my real focus. And then the baseball songs, etc. But to make up a story, that's outside of what I've been doing for many, many years now.
One other song from Tulips for Lunch resulted from Chuck's participation in that Michigan songwriters retreat. It's the aforementioned ping pong ballad, though in this case, some of the inspiration came direct from Chuck's own experience.
I actually wrote that song as a big metaphor. You know, I did play ping pong literally with my dad every night after dinner, and on one level I tried to make the song work literally, but it's a lot deeper than that. It's really about the father-child relationship and how I'll use myself as the example, you know, getting to my teens and becoming a bit more rebellious and outspoken and typical clashes that a teenager might have with his father, and then come in full circle to where you realize the whole point of it all is just hanging out and spending time. Nobody has to be right.
Now I don't want to slam it all. Don't want him to have to chase the ball. Let's just keep this thing in play. That's the whole point anyway.
Tulips for Lunch also includes a football ballad, The Great Santa Snowball Debacle of 1968, which recounts a somewhat famous instance of Santa Claus being booed by fans of the Philadelphia Eagles. But lest you worry, he's moved on from his fascination with baseball, a fascination which has led to his performing his baseball ballads on several occasions at the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. He hasn't. Tulips includes 2 new baseball ballads, one recounting the curse of the billy goat that was put upon the Chicago Cubs in 1945 and reportedly still holds, and another of a lesser-known story, the Death Row All-Stars, whose title describes the exact circumstances surrounding the team.
The fact that the players were playing for their lives, and as long as they kept winning, they would be granted stays of execution. The club's manager, or the, you know, the prison warden, and the local judge who were betting on the team and making money off of them winning. So as long as they kept winning, the players, they were all on death row at the time, so they all kept getting stays of execution. But if they started losing, players started messing up in the field or at bat, you know, next thing you know, they were given an execution date just a few days later.
The warden bet on us to win, so did the judge, the two were friends. Our executions would be stayed dependent on how well we played.
The Death Row All-Stars came about after Chuck stumbled upon a book of the same name. Some of the tunes on Tulips for Lunch came from suggestions and stories told to him by audience members. Mary the Elephant, about an elephant hung in Tennessee for a quote-unquote murder, and The Unreliable Taxi about, well, an unreliable taxi. But Tulips also features one song not suggested by a listener, but about an actual listener, the man who blew kisses.
I was up at a festival in Nova Scotia, and out in front of me was a group from a local home for the developmentally disabled, and there was this fella, his name was Arthur, and he was about 30 or 40 feet in front of me into the audience, and the entire 45 minutes I was on stage, he stood there blowing kisses at me and dancing around and clapping his hands and moving around to the music and having the time of his life. And in the moment, I was so taken by it that in between songs, I blew kisses back, and you know, all 7,000 people were sort of in on this, and it was a pretty special experience, I think, for everybody, myself most of all.
Man, blue kisses, he blew them at me. It tickled my heart and it buckled my knee. It made my voice crack and it righted all wrongs. My blue kisses back at the end of the songs.
But for all the songs suggested by other people or assigned by other people, there's still the occasional tune direct from Chuck's life. Special not just for that fact, but for the messages Frank conveyed, one that every musician hopes to see passed on.
It was a person that I know who did that, found out about a little girl in her community that whose mother couldn't afford to keep renting her the flute that she was using to take lessons on, and this little girl had to drop out of the school band and was heartbroken. And the woman in the holler found out about this through the grapevine and happened to have a flute that she was given when she was a little girl, and many years had gone by since she last played it, and she understood that a musical instrument needs to be played and shouldn't be sitting in a case in a closet somewhere, so she decided to pass it on with a very beautiful special note she had written to this little girl explaining how it was now hers, and should a day ever come when she found that she wasn't playing it anymore, that she should pass it on. So the whole spirit of it was something that I thought was special and needed to be written up and celebrated.
So here's to the future of music. Here's to the power of song. And here's a toast to the woman in the holler for passing these things along.
A toast to the woman in the holler from Chuck Brodsky's latest CD, Tulips for Lunch. Chuck performs tonight in a show sponsored by the Down East Folk Art Society. Tonight he's at Clausen's Restaurant in Beaufort. The show starts at 8 o'clock. I'm George Olson.
Had a case, it was covered with stickers and words that this woman had scrawled from the magic places she had been to. Trinkets from her own Mardi Gras. And it all meant nothing to Catherine. Well, it wasn't her story to tell. She'll have her own words and stickers should she ever fall under the spell. So it's Catherine's turn now to hold her. Here's hoping she'll learn how to play. Maybe she'll drop by the holler to visit this woman someday. with her boyfriend, the one who plays saxophone. Maybe they'll play for the woman a few things they made up on their own. So here's to the sweet gift of music, and here's to the power of song. Here's a toast to the woman in the holler for passing these things along.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features that you'd like to hear on the Downeast Journal, you can drop us a line at the NewsHound link at publicradioeast.org.